I believe very, very strongly in the ability for humans and technology and creativity and inventiveness to solve for problems. And I believe we're going to get there. I think it's more fun to be a kind of paranoid optimist than, you know, a very sort of cynical, negative pessimist. It's just more fun to wake up in the morning and believe in humanity and the human project. And so I choose that perspective. But yes, I don't discount that we're doing a lot of bad, bad things, and we need to change that.
Hey, it's Steph Dixon, and welcome to the Live Wide Awake podcast. Thank you for being one of our listeners in 88 countries around the world. Today, we're speaking with Mark Nicholson, founder of Private Members Club 1880. Now, Mark has been an entrepreneur for over 17 years with a very colorful past, including child acting, manning a suicide hotline, coaching Cyprus national squash team, volunteering in an Indonesian village, venture capital, advertising, men's grooming, and even a stint in the U.S. Naval Academy. In this episode, we talk about the power of conversations, the importance of human connection, the future of humanity, being lost, and big transformations, why listening is good for our health, and so much more. Okay, it's time to live wide awake. Okay, well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us on the Live Wide Awake podcast. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. And I'd love to start with your childhood, which provided the springboard for your love of conversation. So walk us through this very unique yet unconventional upbringing that you had.
Yeah, thanks. It's a pleasure. I'm so excited to be on your podcast. Thanks for inviting me. I grew up in Montreal, Canada. My parents started to host a dinner, and it was really just a very random and coincidental thing. There was a person who would come to Montreal to teach a course at university, and then he would spend the night at our house and travel back to Ottawa the next morning. So the class would end at 8:30. He would come to our house at 9. So my parents started to invite people who they thought would have interesting conversations with him. And so the number of people escalated very quickly. And so when I say that we would hold these weekly salons, people think it was like 10, 12 people, but we'd get up to 70, 80 people in this kind of two rooms that we had in our house. And my father would chair a discussion around the big geopolitical events of the time, the ethical debates of the time, what have you. I mean, any topic, all the way down to who's going to fix the potholes in the city, you know? And we would have diplomats, academics, activists, social warriors, you name it, just a really wide-ranging group of people and a vastly wide-ranging number of topics. And so it was formative for me. I was 12 years old when this started, and it was formative because I got to sit in the back of the room and just listen to people. And, you know, we could have a conversation around any topic. Thursday mornings were always the most educational because we would wake up and sort of sit around the breakfast table and talk about the conversation the night before. And so, Stephanie, why this was formative and important for me is that I realized that I was forming my values based on the information that I was acquiring and processing. And that was really great. No one handed me a booklet and said, okay, you are going to be a white Anglo-Saxon Christian from a middle-class background, you know, in Canada, and that'll be your value system. It was more like, hey, here's the gamut of what's possible. You figure it out. You decide what you want to believe. And that's like an amazing thing. So I'll stop there, but I'll just leave, like, say this little bit. My parents have now hosted over 2,400 consecutive salons. It's called the Nicholson's Wednesday Night Economic and Political Salon. Not very well branded.
Quite a mouthful.
Yeah. But they've never missed a week in 42 years. Like, it's insane. It's such a wonderful institution. And like, what a great environment to grow up in. Like, I feel very lucky to have had that experience.
Yeah, I think that's so incredible. I can't even imagine being at the age of 13 or 12, even when you started, and being exposed to such a variety of different ideas and viewpoints and being able to learn how to process that, but also just being exposed to different ideas and learning how to navigate through what you feel, what your values are. But then I love that you had this sort of debrief at breakfast the next day. I'm sure that, you know, would have been even more anchoring to solidifying exactly how you felt about it all. So I think it's absolutely incredible that you had that growing up. And so were there a couple of evenings that you still like really stand out for you that were actually like really life-changing, or did they all kind of merge into one in the end?
It's a great question, because there are some pivotal nights. Like 9/11 was kind of a massive thing for everybody to absorb, and everybody just came together more to be together than to debate anything. But from a conversation point of view, I think somewhere in the mid-90s, we held an evening on female reproductive rights. And my dad invited a Catholic priest. He invited a woman who had been, she was a rape victim, and we met her through a kind of a sexual assault clinic, and professor of medicine, ethics, and law, and then a whole bunch of other kind of erudite and fascinating minds. And we held a discussion about the rights of a fetus. And I mean, I got to hear all sides of the argument. And this, it's a perfect example of why I think conversations are necessary and important and powerful. Because I mean, I was quite young and I hadn't really formed my views. I didn't really know all the things that you needed to know. So at what point does medicine believe that a fetus is a life? You know, at what point does the church believe that? And by the way, who gets to tell a woman who's been raped, who is the mother of her own children and married to a gentleman, who gets to tell her that she has to carry this baby for 9 months and then parent it? That was like a very intense conversation. There were probably about 30, 40 people in the room, and I was really, really torn. And so what I realized is, you know, when you get into a debate with somebody, when you start talking about a value system or a moral position or an ethical thing, what happens is if someone hits you with an argument that is strong enough to puncture your conventional wisdom, then you kind of have to open your mind up and go, oh, wait, I need to adjust. I need to absorb this and give myself room to maybe think differently, maybe reevaluate my position on this and evolve. Or it doesn't puncture your conventional wisdom and you just sort of say, you know what? I'm sticking with my hand. You're batshit crazy. I don't agree with you. And that's fine too. But what it does is it allows you to confirm or reevaluate your values, your morals. And ultimately, I think that that kind of like seeps into the legal system and the frameworks around which we choose to govern our lives.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so you had a very active childhood in your teenage years, from child acting and from even being on a suicide hotline operator. Like, what drew you to do those things at such a young age as well? It's quite heavy work in both capacities, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't, none of that was really intentional. It was just sort of very fortunate. I literally responded to an ad in a newspaper that I saw when I was 10 years old that was like, come one, come all, we have a theater company. And so I jumped on my bicycle and I went down and I joined this theater company. And it turned out that that theater company was producing work on its own. So I evolved with that company and I eventually joined the board when I was 14. But all the work that we did was created by the kids. So we wrote our own plays and we, you know, music was all performed by our band, but it was written and performed, and the scripts were written, the lyrics were written, the makeup, the costumes, the set design, everything was done by the kids. And that was very empowering, but we generally handled quite difficult topics, sometimes in a very light and amusing way, and sometimes not. And so we did a play that I was a co-writer on teenage suicide called Life at the End of the Rope. Not a particularly uplifting topic, but it was a very impactful play. And we wound up performing it in high schools. It just sort of brought awareness. This is in like 1985, but bringing awareness to, you know, teenage depression and issues around suicide. As a result of that, I got very interested in kind of suicide prevention work. And I wound up calling Suicide Hotline and asking if I could volunteer there. And they said, you know, how old are you? I said, I'm 16. And they said, you have to be 21 to go through the program. There's a training program. And I said, hey, look, I wrote this play. Would you please read the play? And if you think it's good. And so anyway, they did. They read the play. And they said, you can come and do the training. And we won't promise you anything. At the end of the training, we'll see. And, you know, I got through the training. They were like, okay, we're going to let you work the phones on a couple of shifts. And so I wound up working there for about 4 years and probably logged over 1,000 hours on a suicide hotline. Yeah, it's not normal teenage behavior. I get that. But it was very formative. It was like unbelievable.
Yeah, I can imagine. So what were some of the main things that you took from that time then? Like, how did that sort of help to form different views or help to like lead you into other places?
Yeah, I think the number one thing was an appreciation for kind of the vulnerability that we all have and the pain that a lot of people walk through life with that is just super, super difficult. So I would do shifts from like midnight to 8 a.m. and then I would get on the bus and go home and I'd sit on the bus and I'd look at people and I'd be like, I could have spoken to you an hour ago. Everybody, I just sort of got this feeling that anybody and everybody is susceptible to going down a very dark path and really feeling lousy. And what they need more than anything is to be heard and to be felt and to be, for someone to just be empathetic. That it was a really, really big lesson for me. We need human connection.
So such a young age to be exposed to such depth of understanding of human connection, empathy, and yeah, I'm quite blown away by that, to be honest. And so how did that help you? Because I've understood that you've also been gone through periods where you felt quite lost. You know, you've had bankruptcy once in your lifetime as well, which would have been a very painful experience. So were you able to draw on what you kind of experienced when you were helping others to identify your own pain during that time? Or did you also fall deep into the darkness and need help? I mean, I'm
not at all. Yeah. So no, not at all. Like everything I learned, I completely threw out the window when I went through my own like really challenging times. And so this is I think I'm figuring this out as I get older and older, but the sort of very trite saying, you have to learn to love yourself. I still don't know what it means. Like, I don't know how it works completely, but I think it begins with forgiveness. I think that's a really big thing, you know? So you're right. I went through a very, very hard time after a business that I was running went bankrupt and we had to close the doors and I had like 60 staff and it was emotionally very, very difficult for me. I felt like a huge failure. I felt I'd failed my staff, you know, and by the way, Lehman Brothers went bankrupt like 3 weeks before us. And, you know, the complete 2008 financial crisis was happening around us, but I still blamed myself and nobody else. And I couldn't accept that maybe there were some macro forces at play, but it was more, you know, how could you do this? And I was not forgiving. I was not nice to myself. And that was hard. You know, I can't say anything else about it. I wish that I had better tools at my disposal to deal with that. I went to a dark place and it took me a while to come out. And I, of course, I came out a lot better for it, but anybody who tells you that failure is a good lesson, I mean, they're not wrong, but it's not a nice lesson. It's not, I don't, you know, wish it on anybody. It sucks.
Yeah, absolutely. But now I feel like, you know, you're in a fantastic place. I mean, at least it comes across that way. And you said that, you know, you couldn't be happier now. So it's still a work in progress. And I think that's such a beautiful concept because I think it doesn't matter how old we get. It doesn't matter what we go through, that life is a constant work in process and progress and happiness is as well. So what's that journey been like for you?
Yeah, I mean, so I went on my own sort of journey. I attended a lot of kind of conferences and wellness activities. And so I think once a year I try to do something deep diving that will open my mind to a different way of seeing the world and a different way of thinking. And I find that very rewarding. I do think that maybe it's Western medicine. We think, oh, well, I can just take a pill and I'll be all better and that will fix it. And whatever that pill might be, like, oh, I'll just go get incredibly fit and take control of my body and then I'll be better mentally. Or you know, I'll go down the path of drinking excessively and being unhealthy and whatever. What I'm trying to say is those little things that you do, those, you know, oh, maybe I'll delve into meditation, but I can only do it for 5 minutes a day because my mind wanders too quickly, you know, and then I'll read a self-help book and then I'll talk to somebody and maybe I'll go to my church and see a priest or I'll see a psychologist. And what I'm trying to say is you can't expect that any one of those things is going to be a catch-all fix everything. But all of those things put together and time, you don't even realize how much you're transforming. And it's sometimes one might wake up and go, I'm no longer that person I was 3-4 years ago when I was massively depressed. And I've learned to cope and I've learned to recognize and I've learned to forgive and I've learned to live more in the present and not dwell on the past and turn that voice off in my head that tells me I'm a failure or I'm incomplete in some way or I'm an imposter. You know, all that stuff, it's a gradual, can be a slow process, but I do believe it is happening and it's powerful and you can't give up on it. You have to kind of trust it and stick with it. And sometimes you just kind of have to give way and say, okay, you run the show for a while, whatever force you are out there. I'm going to sit back and just ride the wave. Yeah, this is something I've come to understand and it's made my life a lot easier.
Yeah, that's incredibly beautiful as well. You know, I like what you were saying about the granular, small micro things that you do over time that lead to that huge transformation. Because I think when you think about transforming or getting out of the darkness, or it can seem so overwhelming and like you want to have that one catch-all thing, but actually it's these small little things and it's the repetition and the building, and that helps you to get into stronger and build that foundation like brick by brick again. So I think that's just a really, you know, poignant reminder of how life is and how well-being is and the growth and everything that goes along with it. So would love to understand then how, you know, going through that difficult time then led you to sort of wanting to start a private members club in Singapore.
Okay. Seeing as it's just you and me talking and no one else is listening right now, I will tell you that I actually hate the idea of a members club. And that I understand how weird that sounds. I don't like the term member. I don't like the term club. I don't like private, exclusive, luxury. All of these are anathema to who I am as a person. But unfortunately, the business model serves a purpose. And the purpose was that living in Singapore, I've met amazing people. I everywhere I go, I run into somebody who I'm just inspired by, I'm enthralled with. I just find like, oh, that's so cool. You invest in tech companies in Indonesia, or you are a opera singer, or you make documentary films, and you know, the whole litany of wonderful people. And I was just wondering, like, where's the place where everybody hangs out? And where's that place where we can go and be guaranteed that we're going to run into or have the occasion to hang out with or attend events with people from very diverse backgrounds? And I mean diverse from you. I mean, outside of your industry, you know, spectrum, you can go and meet people who are in artificial intelligence one day and in wellness the next day and, you know, what have you. So the idea was really more, I want to hang out with the people who are building Asia for the next 50 years. That's what was interesting. And so then when I said, okay, let's open a members club, let's make that happen. It was like, well, what's the point of it? You know, like, I don't just want to open a douchey private members club. I want it to stand for something. And that's when I'd look to my parents and the Wednesday nights and the salon talks and the power of conversation that I thought, let's make it about that. You know, let's really focus on bringing people together and trying to have very difficult conversations and trying to enroll people who are not involved. In other words, where are the poets and the artists and the diplomats in the discussion on the development of artificial intelligence? You know, all the tech guys, yay, great. But why aren't other people involved in that? So we do a lot of that. You know, we do talks on every manner of subject. And, you know, just because it's on my mind, we did a talk on men's mental health last week. Unbelievable eye-opener. Men are in a ton of pain. And I'm talking about Google executives and entrepreneurs and doctors and lawyers and and they're suffering, and there's a great deal of need to heal, but there's not enough access to that. And men don't want to, and blah, blah, blah. And so that's a really kind of big area that I think we're interested in exploring more. So anyhow, yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
That's why.
No, absolutely. And I think that's a really beautiful mission, and it's obviously come together very well. I mean, your programming is always so insightful and enticing. I've always, been drawn to a lot of the programming that you've done. So, but a place like Singapore, obviously, you know, there's still a lot of taboo topics. And I think especially publicly for, you know, people who aren't Singaporean or PR, you know, there is a risk to be too vocal about certain things. And so have you found that that's at all limited the kinds of conversation you're able to have at the club, or it's almost created like the opposite of like a safe space where people can really finally express themselves?
On the whole, safe space, people can express themselves. We generally follow a rule that what happens in the room stays in the room. We don't allow filming. We don't record in any way. There are some times when we do, but generally we've not shied away from big conversations, you know, 377A and LGBT rights in Singapore, education, freedom of speech. You know, these are all topics that we've been willing to explore. Legalization of drugs, we've decided not to do in Singapore. We just kind of thought there was no reason to do that, but we had requests, like people wanted to do it. Yeah. But that was like, we're not preaching anything. We're not arguing any one side. You know, we do want to open people up to seeing an issue from a different point of view. But for example, we did a talk on gun control in the US, you know, and invited a couple of military people and people from the South and, you know, kind of NRA Republicans who really stuck to their guns and very strongly shared why they support the right to bear arms and why they're against gun control. And that's a very, very difficult argument for many liberal-minded non-American people to understand. And I thought it was great that happened, and it was heated and emotional. But then afterwards, we all kind of decamped to the bar and sort of became friends, and civil discourse happened. And it's like, I don't need to hate you because you believe this. I can respect you for how you've evolved your thinking. And as long as you're opening to listening to my argument, then we've got, you know, kind of a mutual, respectful, trustworthy forum. And I find that very powerful. And that we've done on any number of issues, gender equality, human rights, I mean, all kinds of topics that can be quite divisive. And I don't think we've ever seen like people storm off in a fight and in anger. You know, it's really like, oh, it's interesting that you feel that way. I don't agree with you, but okay. It's powerful. I love it.
Yeah, I think it's very powerful, and it's great that you're able to actually foster a space for people, because I think when you have those types of conversations, you're learning as well. You know, you're being, as you said earlier, you're forced to address your values, see where the levers are, see where the flexibility is, maybe where you can kind of expand a bit, but also, yeah, just be able to actually have a intellectually stimulating conversation with someone to try and understand different points of view. And I think that's a gift. I think that's a gift in today's world, without it going to polarization or, you know, as you said, like very heated to the point that there's no resolve. I mean, being able to have that in an adult, intelligent and curious way is something that's really special. So I read that obviously, you know, having a private members club, even though you don't like all of those terms and labels, you also don't even like the label of community, which really is something that you're kind of building. But I'd love to hear like why the word community bugs you and what you focus on instead.
I think the word bugs me because too many people are using it now to say, you know, I'm going to say all this, am I? Yeah, okay. Companies hire a community officer, and then that person is supposed to, I don't know, organize a trip to the zoo or a walk around the river or group meditation. And that's it. And I don't like events where you sort of fill out your, hi, my name is Mark name tag, and they serve coffee and they go, oh, it's a community building exercise. It's not. And so it's not that I don't like the word community or reject the concept of community. I think I believe very, very strongly in the concept of community. I just don't like people using the word and not understanding it and not appreciating actually how difficult it is to build a community. And I think people say, oh, well, you've built a great community at 1880. And I'm not really sure I understand that yet. I know that we have many sub-communities and many people have grouped, formed friendships around a single thing. So, for example, the meditation group, a very tightly knit group, there are multiple. And I think that's super important. But regardless of all that stuff, the underlying principle is very simple. We need human-to-human interaction. We don't do well when we're isolated. COVID taught us all that around the world. And the ability to form friendships, and it doesn't mean you have to be an extrovert. You can be a massive, shy, introverted person, but you still require and thrive or will be better off having close human connections, bonds to whether it's your family, a couple of friends, you know, your community that you live in, or a place like this. That is a principle that we operate under. It's the foundation of our hospitality, is that we exist to help people form stronger connections to each other. And that, to me, you know, maybe I'm just turning the concept of a restaurant into a really highfalutin moral purpose, but I actually believe it very strongly. I think loneliness is the worst possible thing that humans can go through, and isolation is a terrible way to deal with your problems. Empathy, kindness, chatting, friendship, these are, you know, there's a Harvard study that's been going on, and Malvinger is the director of the program, been going on since 1938, and the number one conclusion of this study is that the stronger your bonds to your family, your spouse, your children, your parents, to a small group of friends, to your community, the stronger those connections, the physically, mentally, and spiritually healthier you will be in your old age. It's not about cholesterol levels. It's not about the car we drive. It's not about the job title. It's not about the size of our bank account. It's literally about the friendships that we have. And so if you want to be healthy, forget going for a run. Send a message to your mother, you know, call a friend and say, let's get together for coffee. It's way better for your health. It's way better for the planet's health than any supplement you can take.
Yeah, beautiful. I love that. And so you've had obviously a lot of exposure to different people. A vast range of topics are explored constantly all around you. So with all of these different conversations, how do you feel about the future of humanity?
Yeah, you're dangerous. So I get off on going to dinner parties and annoying people by asking them, how long do you think humans will continue to inhabit the planet? And I get shocking responses. Some people will say, well, maybe one generation, and some will say maybe 100 years. And I'm like, if you believe that, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing right now? I don't know, working as a dental technician. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you honestly think the world is going to end in the next 100 years, you should be doing something different. Very, very rarely do I get people who will say 1,000 years or 10,000 years. Now, if you ask me, I think it's over 1,000,000 years. I think we've got 1,000,000 generations to go. And we have only had about 400 generations in, you know, kind of civilized society grouped around villages. We are nascent. We are tiny. We're fetal. We're barely starting to walk. We are in the very, very early stages of what I like to think of as a human project, right? And so what is that human project? That is about us figuring out how we all live on this planet and give access to food, education, healthcare, safety, home. We're all trying to figure that out. Every government, every regime, every society is trying to figure that out. Some want to take more for the rich people and make the poor people work harder. Some are more egalitarian, you know. But in general, we recognize that keeping people alive is generally a good thing. And if we didn't, by the way, we wouldn't be here. We'd have messed this up a long time ago. Now, people get really mad at me when I say this and they go, hey, does that mean you don't care about the environment right now? Does that mean you're not concerned about nuclear war? Or, you know, how we're going to feed the earth? Absolutely not. We're in a very, very dangerous, precarious time. I believe very, very strongly in the ability for humans and technology and creativity and inventiveness to solve for problems. And I believe we're going to get there. I think it's more fun to be a kind of paranoid optimist than, you know, a very sort of cynical, negative pessimist. It's just more fun to wake up in the morning and believe in humanity and the human project. And so I choose that perspective. But yes, I don't discount that we're doing a lot of bad, bad things and we need to change that.
Yeah, no, be paranoid optimist. I think that's great. Very succinct. If you were to distill some of your learnings down to a few key wedges of wisdom, what would they be?
Yeah, so I don't want to sound super trite, but listening is maybe up there with sleep as kind of like the most important things you can do for your health. And I love to get into debates and I love to argue and I love to kind of push people to say what's really underneath. And so I've gotten a lot better at listening to people and hearing people. And so I get richer from that. So I think when I was younger, I thought that I knew everything and I just wanted to convince people that I was right about everything. And as I get older, I convince myself that I'm probably wrong about most things and I stand to learn a lot more if I just listen better. And that's been a really hard lesson to teach my kids. They don't listen to me. But I think that's maybe number one. Number two is that you're not your thoughts. You know, don't take for granted that voice in your head that is telling you, well, that was, you know, you behaved stupidly last night, or, you know, you're not good enough, or you're probably an imposter. You know, that voice in your head, it's not who you are, and you don't have to listen to it, and you don't have to judge that voice and say, if you said that to me, you must be this kind of person. You are a horrible person. It is not true. I'm not a psychologist and I don't want to get into where those thoughts come from, but they're nothing more than passing thoughts. And who you really are is a way more interesting, wonderful, full of potential, empathetic, you know, compassionate human being. And that's what you need to listen to. And I think that is a super hard thing to switch channels when you need to. And especially, you know, maybe we all suffer forms of depression, some far more deeper than others. And it's giving into that voice that sends you down that rabbit hole and makes it darker and darker and darker. And if you really can master the art of turning that off, of not paying attention to it, of not believing it, you can be in a much better place mentally.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
I don't know if that's wise or...
It's very wise. Yes, I think so.
Thanks.
It was one of the biggest things that I struggled with as well, like disconnecting from the thoughts. And for me, reading The Untethered Soul, I don't know if you read that book, but that book was life-changing. And it really helps to like give you some structure and understanding around that disconnection from your thoughts and being able to sit back and witness everything and not get like completely have your attention captured and drawn into it all. So very powerful. And how do you think that we can live wide awake?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely tied to not listening to the voice all the time. I do share the idea that social media is a difficult thing. It's not a net positive. There are some very good things about it, but it is definitely contributing to higher anxiety levels, stress levels, depression, particularly in kids. And so if there was an invention that I could bring to a market, like if I ever could make a product I thought would be really useful, it would be one that automatically turns phones off for a 12-hour period and there's no way to turn it back on. I think that would be a gift to humanity and I dearly hope someone does that. We need less time digital and obviously more time in nature and more time with friends. That would be the number one thing that I would change in the world right now.
Amazing. Well, Mark, Thank you so much for sharing and for going so deep with us today. I really appreciate it and your passion for life and all the learnings and yeah, everything. So thank you.
Thanks, Stephanie. It's been great. I really enjoyed it.
Three things I'm taking away from this conversation with Mark. Firstly, catch all, fix everything doesn't exist. It is the small, gradual, repeated things over time that leads to big transformation. So just trust the process and stick with it. Secondly, let's be paranoid optimists over cynical pessimists and believe in humanity and the human project. And thirdly, listening is up there with sleep as one of the most important things that we can do for our health. You stand to learn way more if you listen. I'm curious, what did you think about the episode and what were your main takeaways? Is there a topic you want me to dive deeper into? I'd love to hear from you. You can find me at Steffel Dixon or at Live Wide Awake. If you got something out of the podcast and you want to continue this journey with us, consider subscribing and supporting. I hope that today's conversation stirred something deep within you, ready to awaken. And until next time, live wide awake.